Right then, all you brilliant minds gearing up for that SCE in gastroenterology. We know you're deep in the trenches of revision, and today we're diving into a topic that is practically guaranteed to rear its head in the exam. Irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS for short.
Yes, IBS, the chameleon of gastrointestinal disorders. It's certainly a frequent flyer in clinical practice, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Now, for this deep dive, we've got a stack of resources to sift through. The latest NICE guidelines, some key insights from the British Society of Gastroenterology, and a couple of particularly intriguing research articles.
Fascinating, really. What's fascinating here is how much our understanding of IBS has evolved, moving away from that old diagnosis of exclusion mentality.
Okay, let's unpack that a bit. What do you mean by diagnosis of exclusion?
Well, you see, in the past, we often resorted to labeling a patient with IBS simply because we couldn't find any other obvious cause for their symptoms. But now we recognize IBS as a disorder of gut-brain interaction, a true DGBI, which means there's a lot more going on than meets the eye.
So it's not just about ticking off a checklist of symptoms anymore.
Not at all. We need to consider the complex interplay of factors, you see. Motility disturbances, visceral hypersensitivity, alterations in the gut microbiome, and even the role of the immune system. It's a multifaceted beast, this IBS.
And of course, we can't forget the psychological component. Stress, anxiety, depression, these can all play a significant role, can't they?
Indeed. The brain and the gut are in constant communication. And when that dialogue goes awry, well, it can manifest as a whole host of symptoms.
So how do we actually pin down a diagnosis of IBS then? I know there were those Rome food criteria that everyone seems to bandy about, but what about NICE? Do they have their own set of guidelines?
They do indeed. And while there is considerable overlap between the two, there is a rather crucial distinction that often catches people out, particularly in the exam setting.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Lay it on us then. What's the catch?
Well, you see, NICE places a strong emphasis on the temporal relationship between abdominal pain and defecation. For a diagnosis of IBS, according to NICE, that pain needs to be relieved by defecation or at least associated with a change in stool frequency or form.
Right. So it's not just about having abdominal pain in general. It's about that specific connection to bowel movement.
Precisely. And this is where those handy ABCs come into play. Abdominal pain relieved by defecation, bloating, and change in bowel habit.
Good old mnemonics. Always a lifesaver, especially when you're facing down a mountain of information for the SCE.
Indeed. But beyond the mnemonics, understanding the nuances of these diagnostic criteria is crucial. You see, Rome 4 relies more on symptom-based criteria, while NICE incorporates a bit more of a holistic approach considering the patient's overall clinical picture.
So while we're trying to nail down a diagnosis, we also need to be thinking about those red flags, right? The things that tell us this might be something more sinister than just IBS.
Absolutely. Unexplained weight loss, nocturnal symptoms, rectal bleeding, a family history of colorectal cancer or inflammatory bowel disease. These are all red flags that should prompt further investigation. We can't afford to be complacent.
With those red flags in mind, our initial investigations should focus on what exactly?
Well, firstly, a thorough history and physical examination are paramount. Really listening to the patient's story and picking up on those subtle clues can make all the difference. Then we move on to our basic blood tests, full blood count, CRP, ESR, and of course,
fecal calprotectin. That's our go-to for ruling out inflammatory bowel disease, isn't it?
It is indeed. It's a highly sensitive marker for intestinal inflammation and can help us differentiate between IBS and conditions like Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis.
So we've got our bloods, our calprotectin. Are there any other investigations we should be considering at this stage?
Well, it depends on the individual case, of course. If we're suspecting IBSD, particularly in younger patients, it's worth considering testing for celiac disease. And for those over 50, or if any red flags are waving at us, a colonoscopy would be the next logical step.
Right, because we want to be absolutely sure we're not missing anything serious.
Precisely. And remember, in certain cases, further investigations might be needed. Testing for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, lactose intolerance, or even a psychological evaluation if there are significant mental health concerns.
Because, as we've established, IBS isn't just about the gut. It's about the whole person.
Exactly. And that brings us rather nicely to the management of IBS, which, as you might imagine, is just as multifaceted as the condition itself.
So where do we even begin with management? It seems like a bit of a minefield.
Well, the cornerstone of IBS management is
patient education.
Yeah.
We need to explain that this is a chronic condition, help them identify their individual triggers, and really emphasize that it's a team effort. Doctors, dietitians, therapists, all working together to help them manage their symptoms.
Couldn't have put it better myself. Empowering patients with knowledge and a sense of control over their condition is absolutely crucial. Now, alongside education, we've got our lifestyle modifications, and one of the most impactful interventions we can recommend is...
regular exercise.
Hmm?
I know it sounds simple, but getting that body moving can do wonders for gut health.
Indeed. Exercise helps regulate bowel motility, reduces stress, and can even have a positive impact on the gut microbiome.
And of course, we can't forget about stress management techniques like mindfulness or cognitive behavioral therapy, especially given the strong link between the brain and the gut.
Absolutely. Now, shall we delve into the fascinating world of dietary strategies for IBS?
Lead the way. I know this is an area where patients often have a lot of questions and misconceptions.
When it comes to dietary advice for IBS, there's a lot of noise out there, isn't there? Patients often come armed with all sorts of information, some helpful, some not so much.
Oh, absolutely. I've had patients swear by everything from cutting out gluten to drinking celery juice, all based on something they read online.
It's understandable, really. They're desperate for relief and looking for answers wherever they can find them. But our role is to provide them with evidence-based advice, to cut through the clutter and guide them towards strategies that are actually likely to make a difference.
So where do we start then? What are the foundational principles of dietary management in IBS?
Well, first and foremost, we need to emphasize that there's no one-size-fits-all approach. Each patient is unique, their triggers are unique, and their response to dietary interventions will be unique. But there are some general principles that we can apply across the board.
Like making sure they're having regular meals and taking the time to eat properly. I always tell my patients to slow down, chew their food thoroughly, and avoid eating on the go.
Exactly. And staying adequately hydrated is crucial. Many IBS patients find that their symptoms worsen when they're dehydrated.
And what about those notorious gut irritants? Caffeine, alcohol, fizzy drinks. Are they always a no-go?
Well, it depends on the individual, of course. Some patients can tolerate small amounts of these substances without any issues, while others find that even a tiny bit sends their symptoms into overdrive. It's all about trial and error, really, and identifying those personal triggers.
Right. And then there's the whole fiber saga. It seems like the advice on fiber is constantly changing. Should we be encouraging patients to eat more, less, or is it more nuanced than that?
Fiber. The eternal enigma of IBS. You see, the type of fiber matters a great deal. Insoluble fiber, the kind found in whole grains, bran cereals, and the skins of fruits and vegetables, can actually exacerbate symptoms in some IBS patients, particularly those with IBS-C.
I've definitely seen that in my practice. Patients who load up on bran flakes thinking they're doing the right thing, only to find that their constipation worsens.
Exactly. It's because insoluble fiber adds bulk to the stool, which can be helpful for some. But for those with slow gut transit, it can actually make things worse.
So what about soluble fiber then? Is that a better option for IBS patients?
It can be. Soluble fiber, found in foods like oats, linseeds, beans, and lentils, absorbs water in the gut, forming a gel-like substance that can help regulate bowel movements.
Right. So it can help with both diarrhea and constipation, depending on the individual's needs.
Precisely. And there's another dietary culprit that often flies under the radar. Resistant starch.
Resistant starch. Now, that's not one I hear about very often.
Okay.
What exactly is resistant starch, and why is it relevant to IBS?
Resistant starch is a type of starch that, as the name suggests, resists digestion in the small intestine. It then travels down to the large intestine, where it is fermented by bacteria. This fermentation process can produce gas, which can contribute to bloating and discomfort in IBS patients.
So it's not the starch itself that's the problem, it's the byproducts of its fermentation. Interesting.
Indeed. And resistant starch is found in a wide range of foods, including processed foods, underripe bananas, and even cooked and cooled potatoes.
All right. So it's not just about avoiding certain foods. It's about understanding how different components of food are metabolized and how that might impact IBS symptoms. It's all very intricate.
It is. And this brings us to one of the most talked about dietary interventions for IBS, the low FODMAP diet.
Yes, the low FODMAP diet. I know it's gained a lot of traction in recent years, but it's also quite a complex beast, isn't it?
It is indeed. FODMAP stands for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols, which are essentially short-chain carbohydrates that are poorly absorbed in the small intestine.
Okay, so similar to resistant starch, it's not the FODMAP themselves that are inherently problematic. It's what happens to them in the gut.
Exactly. When FODMAPs reach the large intestine, they are fermented by bacteria, producing gas and other byproducts that can trigger IBS symptoms.
So the idea behind the low FODMA diet is to reduce the intake of these fermentable carbohydrates, thereby reducing the fuel for those pesky gut bacteria.
Precisely. And for some individuals, the low FODMA diet can be a real game changer, providing significant relief from their symptoms. But it's not without its challenges.
Right. It's quite restrictive, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it requires a lot of careful planning and label reading.
It does. And it's not meant to be a long-term solution. The elimination phase, where high FODMA foods are strictly avoided, is typically only for a few weeks. Then the focus shifts to reintroduction, gradually adding back different FODMA groups to identify individual tolerance levels.
So it's more about finding those personal triggers than about eliminating entire food groups forever.
Exactly. And this is where the guidance of a registered dietitian is invaluable. They can help patients navigate the complexities of the low FODMA diet, ensuring they're getting adequate nutrition while still effectively managing their symptoms.
Okay, we've covered quite a lot of ground on dietary strategies. Shall we move on to the pharmacological side of things?
Let's do that. It's important to remember that medication isn't always necessary for IBS. Lifestyle modifications and dietary interventions are often sufficient to control symptoms. But when those measures aren't enough, we do have a range of pharmacological options at our disposal.
So let's talk about those options. What are the main classes of drugs we use to manage IBS, and how do they work?
Well, one of the most commonly prescribed medications for IBS is, of course, antispasmodics. These medications work by relaxing the muscles in the gut, reducing spasms and cramping pain.
So they're primarily targeting the pain element of IBS rather than the bowel habits themselves.
Precisely. And they can be particularly helpful for those with IBSD or IBSM, where pain is a prominent symptom.
Now, I know there are a few different antispasmodics out there. Peppermint oil, hyoscine butylbromide, buscopan, Beverine. Do they all work in the same way?
They all aim to reduce smooth muscle spasms, yes, but their mechanisms of action can differ slightly. Peppermint oil, for instance, acts directly on the smooth muscle cells, while hyoscine butylbromide works by blocking a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine, which plays a role in muscle contraction.
And what about mebeverine? Where does that fit into the picture?
Mebeverine is a bit of an enigma, actually. Its precise mechanism of action isn't fully understood, but it's thought to have both antispasmodic and analgesic properties.
Interesting. So it's a sort of multi-pronged attack on those troublesome gut spasms. Now, moving on from pain management, what about those patients who are struggling with constipation? What do we have in our pharmacological arsenal for IBS-C?
Well, for IBS-C, our first-line options typically involve either bulk-forming laxatives or osmotic laxatives.
Right. So bulk-forming laxatives, those are things like psyllium, aspergilla husk, methyl cellulose, right? They work by adding bulk to the stool, stimulating bowel movements.
Exactly. They absorb water in the gut, forming a gel-like substance that helps to soften the stool and make it easier to pass.
And they're generally well tolerated, aren't they?
They are, but it's crucial to emphasize the importance of taking them with plenty of fluids. Otherwise, they can actually worsen constipation.
Right. So it's not just about taking the medication. It's about taking it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about osmotic laxatives? How do they differ from bulk-forming laxatives?
Osmotic laxatives, such as lactulose and macrogols, polyethylene glycol, work by drawing water into the bowel, softening the stool, and increasing its volume.
So they're sort of pulling water into the gut from elsewhere in the body.
Precisely. And this increased water content helps to stimulate bowel movements.
Okay. So we've got our bulk-forming laxatives and our osmotic laxatives for IBS-C. What happens when those first-line options aren't cutting it? Are there any other medications we can consider?
There are indeed. One option that's gaining traction is linaclotide. It's a relatively new medication that works by increasing fluid secretion in the gut and accelerating intestinal transit.
So it's sort of speeding up the movement of things through the digestive system.
Exactly. And it's proven to be quite effective for those with moderate to severe IBS-C who haven't responded to other treatments.
Right. But I recall there being some specific NICE guidelines around its use. Didn't we touch on that earlier?
We did indeed. NICE recommends linaclotide only for those whose constipation has persisted for at least 12 months, despite trying other laxatives at optimal doses.
And regular follow-up is essential to assess its effectiveness and monitor for any side effects.
Absolutely. Now, switching gears slightly, what about our patients who are battling diarrhea-predominant IBS? What pharmacological interventions do we have for IBSD?
Well, the first thing this brings to mind is loperamide, the trusty anti-motility agent.
Indeed. Loperamide works by slowing down gut motility, reducing the frequency and urgency of bowel movements.
And it's generally quite effective, isn't it? especially for those sudden urgent dashes to the loo.
It can be very effective, yes. Huh. And one of the advantages of loperamide is that patients can adjust the dosage themselves to find what works best for them.
Right, so it gives them a sense of control over their symptoms, which is always empowering. Now, are there any other options for IBS-D, particularly for those who don't respond well to loperamide?
There are. Another class of medications we sometimes use for IBS-D are 5-HT3 receptor antagonists, such as ondansetron.
Now, 5-HT3 receptors, those are involved in the transmission of nerve signals in the gut, aren't they?
They are indeed. And by blocking these receptors, ondansetron can reduce nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea.
So it's not just for IBS, it's also used for chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting, isn't it?
Exactly. It's a versatile medication with a range of applications. However, it's worth noting that access to 5-HT3 antagonists for IBS is more limited in the UK compared to other countries.
Right. So it's not always our first-line choice. Now, yeah. We've covered antispasmodics, laxatives, anti-motility agents. Are there any other medications that we might use in the management of IBS?
Well, when those first-line options prove ineffective, we sometimes turn to antidepressants, specifically tricyclic antidepressants, TCAs, and selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs.
Now, I know this might seem counterintuitive, prescribing antidepressants for a gut disorder. Can you shed some light on why we might use these medications for IBS?
Certainly. TCAs, such as amitriptyline, have been shown to have analgesic properties and can help modulate pain perception in the gut.
So it's not about treating depression per se, it's about targeting the pain pathways in the gut.
Exactly. And they can also have a positive impact on sleep and mood, which can be beneficial for IBS patients who are struggling with those aspects as well.
And what about SSRIs? How do they fit into the picture?
SSRIs, such as fluoxetine and citalopram, are primarily used to treat anxiety and depression, but they can also have a beneficial effect on gut motility and sensitivity.
Right. So they're addressing the brain-gut connection more directly.
Precisely. And in some cases, they can be more tolerable than TCAs, particularly in terms of side effects.
Okay, so we've covered a wide range of pharmacological interventions for IBS, but I think it's important to emphasize that medications are only one piece of the puzzle.
Absolutely. We can't rely on medications alone. A holistic approach is essential, incorporating lifestyle modifications, dietary strategies, and psychological therapies alongside pharmacological interventions.
And let's not forget the importance of regular follow-up and ongoing support for our IBS patients.
Indeed. Managing IBS effectively requires a collaborative approach between the patient, the healthcare team, and any other relevant specialist.
Right. It's about building a therapeutic alliance, empowering patients to take an active role in managing their condition, and working together to find solutions that improve their quality of life.
Now, to help consolidate all of this information, shall we delve into a couple of example cases? I think it would be helpful to see how these concepts play out in real-world scenarios.
Yeah, absolutely. I think case studies are always a fantastic way to bring the theory to life. Lead the way.
Right then, our first case involves a 28-year-old woman with...
Go on. This sounds interesting already.
Well, she presents with...
Fascinating. What else?
And she.
I see. So what would be our initial approach in a case like this?
Well, the first thing.
Okay, that makes sense. And what about investigations? Would we...
Absolutely. It would be crucial to...
Right, to rule out any.
Exactly. And depending on the results of those initial investigations, we might then consider.
Okay. So how would we approach management in this case? Would we start with?
In this particular case.
Right. And if those measures weren't sufficient, would we consider?
Absolutely. We could certainly consider.
And it's crucial to remember the importance of.
Indeed. Providing that reassurance and support can make a world of difference.
Well, that was a great case to illustrate the complexities of IBS and the importance of individualized management. Shall we move on to our second case then?
Let's. Now, this next case presents a slightly different challenge.
I'm intrigued. Tell me more.
Right. We have a muscle.
Interesting. And what are his main symptoms?
He reports.
And has he?
He has.
I see. What would be our next steps?
Well, given his.
Right. So we need to.
Precisely. And once we have a clearer picture.
Okay. So in terms of management for this gentleman.
Well, considering his.
And it would be essential to.
Absolutely. Yeah. A multidisciplinary approach is key in cases like this.
Excellent. Well, these two cases have certainly highlighted the diverse presentations and management strategies we encounter in IBS.
Indeed. And it underscores the importance of staying up to date with the latest guidelines and research.
Absolutely. A huge thanks to you for guiding us through this intricate world of IBS. For all our listeners out there, remember, this deep dive has just scratched the surface. Keep those brains buzzing, delve into those nice keys guidelines and BSG publications, and we'll catch you next time for another fascinating deep dive. Cheers.